baseball fans, and welcome to a podcast to be named later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell, and it is fantastic weather outside to be talking baseball. Why don't we play two today? It is, I believe, about 12 degrees up here in the Boston area, and if my weather app is even remotely accurate, and I imagine there's about a 20% chance of that being actually true, it feels more like about 5. So we've got 12 degrees, we've got 5-degree wind chill. We've got Frozen Fenway was actually played yesterday. It's a college mini hockey tournament that they do where four of the college teams, the local teams, play each other in a two games, and I think then they play like a final game the following day or something. But that was on Sunday, Frozen Fenway, where they played hockey at Fenway Park, outdoors. So that gives you an idea of what kind of temperatures and weather we're dealing with here. And, of course, on this show, we talk baseball. So I'm looking at snow. I'm freezing my tail off when I go outside. But in here, we're talking hot stove. We're talking Major League Baseball. And today's guest is Sean McAdam, formerly of CSN New England and the Providence Journal. He's going to come on today. He's been on the program many, many times. He's been covering the Red Sox for over 20 years. Love talking American League East baseball. Love talking American League baseball in general. And he knows the whole league. He's been covering the league in its entirety. But his specialty has been the Boston Red Sox. So we're going to be talking about him today, talking with him today. And we're going to be talking about the American League East. Lots to get into. We're going to talk a little bit about general stuff. Because any guest that I have on, any reporter, writer, anyone who knows anything about baseball, I like to get their general thoughts about what's been going on here in the offseason. So I'll get his general thoughts on the relievers and what their contracts have been. The big prospect trade, which impacts the American League East, but also has been a big part of what's happened this offseason. And, of course, we'll talk about the Chris Sale trade. Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, Luis Alexander Basabe, and Victor Diaz going to the White Sox for Chris Sale. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about all the big bats that are unemployed. Mark Trumbull still hasn't signed. Jose Bautista hasn't signed. And, of course, with Jose Bautista, as soon as you look at the circumstances surrounding a guy like him and his circumstance, you start to hear about rumors that he's going to hang out on the free agent market until after whatever it is, June or whatever it might be, so that he's no longer attached to draft pick compensation. And then he'll sign with somebody. You always hear about that with a player that looks like he's going to be remaining in the free agent market for an extended period of time. Nobody ends up doing that. No one ends up staying available for that long. But you hear about talk about how they're willing to, as if that helps them give them leverage. like they throw it out there publicly that they're willing to, and therefore GMs say, oh my goodness, we shouldn't play hardball with him because he's willing to sit out until he's no longer attached to free agent to minor league draft pick compensation. But we're hearing about that with him. And his situation looks bad. I mean, he's played this completely wrong. He came out arrogantly last year saying that he was worth every single penny. He's not taking a bargain. He's not going to do anything to stay in Toronto. Then now he's even as arrogant as saying that he's willing to do a one-year deal. He's willing to compromise his situation and take a one-year deal. But it's going to have to be more than the qualifying offer of whatever, $17.5 million. It's like, Jose, do you think you have any leverage at this point to be negotiating with anyone about anything? And it doesn't sound like Toronto even wants him back. And with his attitude, I can't honestly blame any team being reluctant to want to sign him. Forget about what money he's demanding or what ridiculous amounts of money he's demanding, but giving up the minor league draft pick that's attached to that, and even more importantly, is the money. Because if you give up a first round pick, you lose a first round pick. That means something. But if you're picking in the 20s or the 30s, you're not usually getting a guy who's supposed to be an impact star. The first five or six prospects are usually potential superstars, or at least potential really good players. Guys who we're talking about, Dansby Swanson, those kinds of guys, Alex Bregman, Carlos Correa, those guys were top five picks. But when you get into the 15s and the 20s, sometimes those players become stars. But the talent level, the elite status, the elite skill set that the players have is not as high. The top five or six are usually very, very high. Once you get into the teens and the 20s and the 30s, you get some stars. I mean, Mike Trout was drafted like 17th overall. Andrew Miller fell all the way into the teens. That was because of money, not because of potential. So that's a little bit of a different situation. But nonetheless, he did get drafted in the teens, and people thought he'd be a star as a starting pitcher. Now he's a star as a reliever, and those players are becoming more and more valuable now. But people don't even want to give up a pick that late in the draft, even though you aren't guaranteed a star player. But the money, these teams are only allotted a certain amount of money to spend every single season on the draft. They can't exceed the totals. So when you have $2 million allotted to a draft spot, if you give up that pick, you also give up $2 million. And one of the ways the teams now do it is they draft a younger player, a lesser player, a cheaper, more affordable player who's willing to sign for under slot money in exchange so that they can spend more money on a player who wants more than his slot is allotted. That happened with the Houston Astros with Lance McCullers and Carlos Correa. Carlos Correa was not drafted number one overall because he was the best player in that year's draft. Actually, Byron Buxton was the best player in that draft. Obviously, things haven't resulted and turned out that way, but that was what the status of the situation was at the time. The reason why the Houston Astros drafted Correa over Buxton was that Correa was willing to take less money. He was willing to take underslot money, significantly less underslot money. And then in exchange, the Astros were going to use that extra money to pay Lance McCullers more than his slot demanded in exchange to convince him to sign with them rather than go to college. So the Astros combined two players, one at a discount, one at an overpay, and they were able to get two high-end guys for the price of what would normally cost two, one really good player and one lesser player. So the money can be distributed however you want to. A lot of times other teams do that with picks who they don't expect to be able to sign. Sometimes they draft a player in the third or fourth round who would have been a first rounder, but nobody expects to sign, so they don't even waste the draft pick on selecting them. Well, teams end up drafting them later on in the draft, the third or fourth round, and then in order to try to steal them away from college, they pay them five times the amount of what that slot is. They essentially pay them almost first-round money, even though they draft them in third and fourth round. You need that allotted money in order to be able to afford to do those kinds of things. And if you lose your draft pick, you lose a lot of that. So, Jose Bautista, good luck to you. But anyway, that was my longer rant. We'll also talk about the American League East. We'll try to get through every single team as much as we can. We'll talk about how the Red Sox are maybe the anointed favorite in the American League East. We'll talk about whether that's actually true or not. And Sean McAdam will be joining us in a second. He's a great person to be talking with that. Because, well, yes, they added Chris Sale, and everyone says, wow, you just added an ace. Of course, the Red Sox are the best team in the American League. They lost David Ortiz, don't forget. And I call that the elephant in the room. David Ortiz had an MVP caliber season last year. Now, I don't think anyone would have picked Ortiz over Betts or over Mike Trout as MVP, but there was a discussion to be made, an argument to be made that he was at least in the top five. All of a sudden, the Red Sox just lose him, and yet they add Chris Sale, and all of a sudden they're the favorites for the World Series. So last year they were just a playoff team, maybe one of the better teams in the American League when you were entering the playoffs, but by no means were they a lock to win the World Series or anything. So they add Chris Sale, but they lose their best slugger, a guy who was a possible top three, top four MVP candidate. He's just gone, and it doesn't seem like anyone, at least up here in Boston, is talking about how significant an impact that could possibly be. So we'll talk about the loss of David Ortiz, the elephant in the room, so to speak. We'll also talk about the American League and how passive it's been. Toronto is just hemorrhaging players for the most part. Baltimore, like they seem to always do, they're not signing anybody, at least as of yet. They seem to wait a long time every single year, and I'm actually expecting that to probably happen this year, but they haven't signed anybody yet. So we'll talk to Sean McAdam about that. We'll talk about the Yankees and the Aroldis Chapman signing. We'll talk about the Rays in a very small way. Are the Rays becoming relevant again? Are their minor league systems building up and they're becoming maybe a possible good team in the next couple of years? Or is this a team that's floundering in an organization that's becoming one of the have-nots and never will be? So we'll talk about that a little bit. If we have time, we will break down the Chris Sale, Yoan Moncada trade. So we'll definitely get into that. We'll talk about Dane Dombrowski a little bit because when we have Sean McAdam here, we have to talk in depth about the Red Sox. I want to talk about what Dave Dombrowski's done so far and what we can expect from him moving forward. Is this minor league system going to be able to be rebuilt? Can Dave Dombrowski not only build a major league team by trading prospects, but can he continue to draft and develop these prospects that they draft into the future so that this minor league system doesn't just become crap? You look at the Detroit Tigers. They've made a lot of trades, and I was surprised at how many trades they were able to make with that minor league system. But the Detroit Tigers do not have a great minor league system right now. And Dave Dombrowski was the president or general manager for a long time there. So what their system looks like now kind of has to be directly contributed to Dave Dombrowski. Is that what we're going to see in Boston? Are we going to go from Theo Epstein that kept the team young, kept the team good, kept the team competitive, won some World Series while he was here, but also developed the best minor league system probably in all of Major League Baseball? It was just a juggernaut that was just pumping out talent year after year after year, and we're definitely seeing it now. I mean, the Red Sox are loaded with minor league talent at the Major League level now. But is that over? Are they trading away all of their prospects? They're not going to replenish. So I'll get Sean McAdam's opinion on what kind of draft and development guy Dave Dombrowski is. I asked Vince Lara from Baseball America his opinion, but I want to get Sean's opinion because he's closer. He's on the ground. He's not a minor league guy per se, but he covers the Red Sox more closely than any of those people. So I'll get his opinion on that. Also, if we have time, and again, we've only got Sean for about 40 minutes, we'll talk about A.J. Preller and the San Diego Padres. And how do you deal with the GM who essentially lied to the league on a multiple occasion? And it did impact the Red Sox directly with the Drew Pomeranz trade. So if we have time, we'll get into that. And I would like to get Sean's opinion on the Hall of Fame since that's kind of in the air at the moment. I want to talk about the steroid era a little bit, advanced metrics and its impact on the voting, and relievers and DHs. Again, kind of impacts the Boston Red Sox and the American League East. Are relievers and DHs ever going to get into the Hall of Fame? Has advanced metrics killed that chance? Would DHs and relievers had a better chance 10 or 15 years ago before all of this war stuff and all of the, how defense and base running has now become so important in the war stat? You see an Adam Eaton traded for two or three elite prospects when he can't even hit 20 home runs or steal 20 bases. 40 years ago, home runs and stolen bases and batting average were the things everyone looked at. Today, we look at war and FIP and ex-FIP for pitchers and OPS plus and things like that. Our advanced metrics, breaking everything down into numbers and ignoring some things that are maybe a little bit more difficult to explain, maybe even in some cases anecdotal, but yet relevant nonetheless. I mean, how does the best player at a position, and a DH is a position, I don't think anyone can argue that DH isn't a position, how can the best player at a position not even be in the Hall of Fame? You look at Edgar Martinez, or you look at David Ortiz, who may or may not get in. How do those guys who are the best that have ever played at a position that exists, that's been in the league for over 30 years, how do those guys not get in on the first ballot, never mind get in at all? But it seems like that'd be the case. That little tarnish of the steroid connection with David Ortiz might be enough that, along with the fact that he's a DH, may eliminate him from being able to get into the Hall. We don't know. I want to get Sean's opinion on that. And then relievers. Keith Law made an interesting point when I was reading his chat the other day about how he thinks Mariano Rivera should be the bar upon which Hall of Fame relievers should be set, which strikes me as interesting because the best reliever of all time is the minimum of how good you have to be in order to get into the Hall of Fame. So if you're not the best that's ever been as a closer, then you don't deserve to be in. That's basically what he's saying. I find that a little bit difficult to totally fathom, but that's his argument nonetheless. But let me bring in Sean McAdam, previously of CSN New England in the Providence Journal. And you can follow him on Twitter at Sean_McAdam. Sean, great to always have you on the program. Love talking baseball with you. Hopefully you're staying a little bit toasty. It's chilly out there, and I know my back's sore from the shoveling.
Yeah, it's winter has arrived full force, obviously, Chris. But good to talk to you. Always enjoy coming on the podcast.
Let me ask you real quickly. We're going to get into hopefully most of the American League, but just what are your general thoughts about what's been going on here in the hot stove in the offseason, the reliever contracts, how they're getting a lot of years? I mean, a lot of money is one thing, but they're also getting a lot of years. The big prospects trade, which 5 years ago, I don't know if we see a Yoan Moncada. If Theo Epstein's here, I don't know if we see a Yoan Moncada get traded at all. But this year we saw not only the Yoan Moncada trade, but the Lucas Giolito and the Ronaldo Lopez trade for Adam Eaton. We saw some of these big bats aren't even finding places. They're still unemployed. What are your general thoughts on what we've seen so far in the hot stove?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I guess if there's a theme to this winter, it's how so many power bats are sort of being kicked to the curb on the free agent market. We recently, of course, saw Encarnacion sign a 3-year deal with an option for a 4th year in Cleveland, but that took a long time. For what was inarguably the best offensive player on the market to land someplace. And particularly in a year in which there were not a lot of pitching options on the free agent market, particularly starting pitching, although there were, as you referenced, a couple of elite, a few elite closers, all of whom got big money. The starting pitching market was so thin, a lot of people thought that teams would acknowledge that and sort of look to improve by bulking up their lineup. But, you know, here we are with Bautista and a lot of other guys. You know, you've got two home run champions in both leagues unsigned in mid-January. That's fairly unprecedented, I would guess. But, you know, there have certainly been some teams that have made some impact moves, not the least of whom include the Red Sox, the Sale deal, and some of the other somewhat less dramatic moves they've made. I think they have improved. I think Encarnacion going to Cleveland is a huge story, not only from a baseball standpoint, but from a business standpoint. When you look at, you know, the Indians being a team that, you know, drew just 1.6, 1.7 million fans last year. They're in a depressed market. They have a hard time selling tickets, and yet they go into the couch cushions and find enough spare change to go out and land the best and maybe make what was the best team in the American League even better. So, you know, the fact that two of the three best teams in the American League as we head into 2017 are going to be in Houston and Cleveland is a little different, and it sort of validates Bud Selig's goal to have a more level playing field so that it isn't all about the big markets all the time.
When the Chris Sale trade happened, at least up here in Boston, but I think across baseball, people pretty much said, well, David Price was a disappointment, but Rick Porcello won the Cy Young. Now you add an ace in Chris Sale. I think a lot of people immediately just leap to the conclusion. Again, it's first reaction, it's recency bias. But nonetheless, the reaction was the Red Sox are the favorites in the American League. Do you think that's actually true? And did the Indians all of a sudden flip the coin? Or were the Red Sox and the Indians closer than everyone gave credit for when that trade happened, and then Edwin Encarnacion maybe flipped it to the Cleveland Indians? Or do you think the Red Sox are the best? Where do things stand? Are those American League right now? Or yeah, is there a third one we should be talking about?
Well, as I said, I think Houston probably needs to counter what the Red Sox and Indians did with their dramatic moves. You know, they made some moves earlier in the season to improve their offense, but I think they need another impact starting pitcher. Whether they can do that before the start of the season, given that there's nobody on the free agent market and that would have to be a trade, you know, if they were all of a sudden to get into trade talks with the White Sox and get Quintana, that would be the kind of guy that could, you know, elevate them close to, I think, the Indians and Red Sox. I look at it this way, Chris. The Indians handily dispatched the Red Sox in three games in the wild card series last year. And we can say that it's dangerous to draw conclusions from three games and the randomness of, you know, of small sample size in the postseason. But, you know, there's little doubt that the Indians were the better team between those two. And when both teams make significant acquisitions, the Red Sox with Sale, the Indians with Encarnacion, you have to think that that balance has not been overturned, that Cleveland remains at least a little bit better than the Red Sox. And then add in the fact that the team we saw in October that mopped the floor with the Red Sox and Blue Jays and then took the best team in baseball to extra innings in Game 7 of the World Series did not have their best overall player in Brantley and their numbers 2 and 3 starters in the postseason, but we'll have them all healthy at the start of next year. Cleveland's still the team to beat. Doesn't mean the Red Sox can't do it or close the gap. I think they are the next best team in the American League, but I still give a slight edge to the Indians.
Yeah, that's the point I was going to ask about you next, and that's a great one, is that if they had Carrasco and Salazar in their rotation going to Chicago, you could make – no one would have argued that the Indians were better than the Cubs going to the World Series, even if they had those pitchers, because I don't think anyone fully realizes just how good Cleveland actually is, or at least how good they were playing. You know, maybe that's part of it, is that the Indians were playing better than maybe looking at their roster makes them seem to be. Maybe that was the case. Maybe they were just one of those teams that was a good team playing great. But if they had Carrasco and Salazar, I think a pretty good argument could be made that they were the better team against the Cubs than the Cubs. I mean, Carrasco and Salazar at times can be aces, and they weren't even on the bump at all, which is essentially what you're saying. So, yeah, I agree with you totally. That's a great point that they were probably playing at 75% of their potential. Now, you know, Mike Napoli had a phenomenal season and things like that. Maybe everything fell right, and again, maybe it was a magical year. But they were definitely, like you said, they were playing at 80% of capacity. And it would have been amazing to see Carrasco versus Arrieta in a pitcher's duel rather than the Indians throwing out seven relievers because Trevor Bauer cut his finger on a drone or something.
Right, and don't discount the impact that Brantley might have had on the season and the postseason. This is a guy who had really just sort of blossomed and finally made 2015. And they have him for, you know, whatever it was, 10 or 12 games last year with various shoulder setbacks. That would have made a difference too. So I'm not exactly saying that the Indians are the chalk, and anybody who says that anybody else can get to the World Series instead of the Indians is crazy. We've seen it's a long season. Things happen that you don't anticipate. But I think on paper, at least going into spring training, Cleveland's the best team in the American League right now.
Yeah, I think I agree, and that's going to lead into a question I want to talk about here in a couple minutes, which is I think people are ignoring or just don't want to address the impact of losing David Ortiz. But before we get there, when the Adam Eaton trade happened, and he was able to bring the White Sox two really good prospects in Lucas Giolito and Ronaldo Lopez. And ever since that trade has happened, we've heard everyone try to tell us about the flaws of those two guys and the war value of Adam Eaton and all that. But I think the initial reaction was that was an insane trade and the White Sox killed it. But then after looking at it deeper and, again, examining the flaws of the prospects and looking at the team control of Adam Eaton, all of a sudden differing opinions, I think, started to become at least more reasonable. You saw some people on one side of the fence, another on the other. It wasn't as lopsided as maybe initial reactions. I'm curious what your thoughts were of the Yoán Moncada trade. What was your reaction when it first happened? Are you shocked that a player as good as Yoán Moncada potentially can be was traded, for one? And because, as I said in the intro, I don't know if Theo Epstein would have ever traded Yoán Moncada, but Dave Dombrowski seems more than willing to trade just about anything that's not nailed down. But what was your initial reaction when it happened? And have you changed it all now that we've had some time to kind of chew on it?
Well, I was a little surprised that they were willing to give up Moncada. I would have thought that they would sort of identify Benintendi and Moncada as two untouchables who certainly Benintendi is ready to contribute insofar as you can make that determination, you know, based on a month and a half. He certainly didn't do anything to dissuade anyone from thinking that he's ready. And while Moncada had a very uneasy debut with the 9 straight strikeouts, he's a guy that I think people would have expected to be kind of in the everyday lineup by the All-Star break in 2017 anyway, and have some sort of impact in the second half of the season, and then be a guy that can, you know, really be a centerpiece going forward. One of the reasons I wasn't convinced to give up on Moncada is purely economic. And remember, it cost the Red Sox about $62.5 million to sign Moncada. Half of that was a penalty that they had to pay for Major League Baseball for going over their international bonus allotment. But they did give him $31 million in change as a signing bonus. And that's sunken money. That's money that's already been spent. It's not as if, you know, Rick Hahn is with the White Sox. They signed Jose Abreu out of Cuba to a major league deal, and that's been the case with a couple of other guys like Yosemite Tomas with Arizona, and Cespedes originally with Oakland, and a number of other elite players who got major league deals. You trade those guys, the team is assuming the rest of that major league contract. In dealing Moncada to the White Sox, the Red Sox weren't pawning off any money that they have spent on Moncada. That's done. It's a signing bonus, and coupled with the luxury tax or the penalty for going over, $62.5 million that you're not getting back. You know, you're essentially kissing that money goodbye. And while I know that from Dave Dombrowski's standpoint, he walks in and says, "Well, that money was spent before I got here. It doesn't impact my future budget. It doesn't impact what I can do in the next draft or with other international free agents going down the road." But I would have thought ownership would have said, "Well, do we really want to do this, having committed this kind of money and resources to this guy and you know, to get a half dozen major league games out of him before dealing him away?" Then you start considering the amount of talent the guy has, which is considerable. And, I guess it is surprising, but as you were saying earlier, Chris, Dave Dombrowski's MO is pretty clear. He's not one who falls in love with prospects. He's a guy that wants results now. He did it in Detroit, and he's certainly done it in Boston in the year and a half that he's been here.
And the way that it was worded in the media, reported by somebody, and maybe it was by one place that I read, and maybe they got it wrong. Let me just, because like you said, that money for Moncada is sunken, but I heard it defined as the Red Sox were picking up the remainder of his contract. So exactly how did that work? Is all the money already paid, or is there $30 million left on Moncada's deal and the Red Sox are willing to absorb that $30 million rather than have the White Sox pay? What is the actual allotment that is remaining? Because I'm curious, because it's a little bit different. Because one of the ways that it was that Chris Sale was defined as such a great deal was, A, of course, he's an elite pitcher. But he's under team control for a fairly long period of time at very cheap dollars. But if the Red Sox are keeping the Moncada money when they didn't have to, that's my question is, if they're keeping and paying Moncada money that they didn't have to if they had traded him, then that all of a sudden makes Chris Sale a lot less cheap. So is all of that Moncada already paid, or was there going to be money in the Red Sox?
That's a signing bonus. That's a signing bonus that was paid to him at the time, in February of 2015, when he joined the Red Sox. So that's not a major league contract. That was money that had to be given to him at the time, and the corresponding $31 million and change that they had to pay to Major League Baseball for their overage or going over their international signing bonus for that signing period. That money's gone. So there's no relief where the White Sox are giving some of that money back. That's money that has been spent and gone.
So what is he earning per year? Is he just a typical minor leaguer?
Yeah, he's a minor leaguer if he makes the team, which is doubtful, they clearly have a vested interest in having him develop and don't want to rush him. They're not trying to win in 2017. But if he is to be part of the White Sox roster in 2017, then he'll make the major league minimum of $525,000 or thereabouts. And he'll continue along that typical salary path where after three seasons he's eligible for salary arbitration, and after four and after six he's eligible for free agency, but the White Sox can pay him next to nothing for the next couple of years.
All right, because that changes my thought process on that trade a little bit, because again, as I heard it reported, it sounded like he was owed, you know, that money was distributed over the years of a deal where he was getting $6 million this year and $8 million. That's what it was. And again, that was reported everywhere, and I don't remember where it was. So I'm not going to – I just remember because I heard the argument that the Red Sox agreed to pick up the rest of Moncada's deal. That's not the case. It's already been paid in full. That makes it a little bit different, because if you had traded Moncada in the deal and then said, well, we paid Moncada $62 million over 6 years, and so that's $10 million a year. We want you to give back $30 or $40 million. That's different than just trading him. So that I wanted to get that clear. I appreciate you bringing that to us because, again, I don't know where I read it or where that was expressed, but that was thrown out there saying, wow, you know, the Red Sox are paying $62 million of Moncada and taking on Sale, and that sort of distorts the reality of the trade. So I appreciate you bringing that back into the reality and the fairness of it because you're not going to ask the White Sox to pay the Red Sox money. So that would be an absurd request. So it's good to know that. Are you shocked that is baseball changing, I guess, is the ultimate question. Then I want to move on to the American League East. When you see the Lucas Giolitos and the Ronaldo Lopez, Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, who could be a really good pitcher as well, is baseball changing, or is it this free agent market, or is it just a fluky year? I don't remember so many top 15 prospects being traded in one off season. We usually hear about them maybe being traded, but this year it actually happened in multiple of them. It's almost like fantasy league where two-star prospects get traded in one deal. A lot of times you don't even see one. CC Sabathia brought home, Tony LaPorta or Michael LaPorta or something to the Indians back in the day. I mean, you don't usually see prospects this good traded.
Yeah, actually one of the guys in there was Mickey Brantley. So that, you know, that one did pay off at least years down the road for the Indians. But, no, you're right. At a time when you hear that general managers and executives and talent evaluators are guarding top prospects, you know, like their firstborn, and won't give them up under any circumstances, it was a little unusual to see as many get put into deals this winter as we've seen with Moncada and the two pitchers you mentioned with the Nationals going to the White Sox for Chris Sale. And I think by virtue of acquiring those three players alone, people have already begun to, you know, fit Rick Hahn for some future Executive of the Year award because they made a decision that the White Sox were nowhere near ready to win, and that's certainly true. And so he did the next best thing, which is to, you know, break up the nucleus of what he had and start cashing in. And he got some elite prospects in return. Some of it may be, as you point out, the fact that it was not a very good free agent market. So, you know, the Adam Eaton equivalent and the Chris Sale available to the Nationals and Red Sox respectively. And so they had to part with pieces that they didn't want to, but each felt compelled enough to make those trades to give them up. But I'm not sure that we're going to see a whole lot of that. I think teams are still, given the economics, given the luxury tax threshold, given the fact that fewer and fewer really star players are getting the free agency, you know, GMs really covet those top elite prospects. It's just that Mike Rizzo and Dave Dombrowski were the exceptions to the rules this winter.
And do you agree or disagree, and how confident are you in your opinion that if Theo Epstein was still here, this trade never happens, at least not in this form, that Yoan Moncada is still here? Is the difference in the GM the reason why that trade happened?
Well, you know, I was going to say, look at the 2005 offseason when the Red Sox gave up what was probably then the equivalent of Yoan Moncada in a young Hanley Ramirez. It's instructive to note that Theo Epstein was off the clock when that deal got made, and there have been various reports about whether he would have made it had he stayed in the front office that winter before leaving and then returning. But there is precedent for the Red Sox to give up that kind of elite prospect if there is the guy out there that they think makes the difference. And, you know, Josh Beckett did help them win in 2007, a year after he got there. And then Hanley ended up coming back, of course, to the Red Sox. But, you know, it's hard to say never in this business because I think there are always, circumstances which dictate you know, some moves that are thought to be the exception rather than the rule.
And Mikey Lowell was a nice little contributor as well. Not a key piece to that trade.
And not anybody really that they wanted. That was something that was shoved down their throat by the Marlins. They wanted salary relief to get out from under the last couple of years of Lowell's deal. Remember, he had a horrible 2005 where he hit like 220 or something, and the supposition was that he was close to done. And then he becomes the, you know, World Series MVP in 2007. So all around, what they got out of Beckett and Lowell, that deal certainly worked out.
And anyone who follows baseball a little bit closely or follows prospects, there's always this warring, these two warring factions of either you always go for the major leaguer because prospects are a crapshoot, or you've got the prospect side where they never want to trade the prospects. And it doesn't really matter what the trade is. Somehow, if you gave up the prospects, you gave up too much. It seems like there are two sides to that war every single time a trade like this happens. Which side of this is going to be miserable with Dave Dombrowski? Is he going to be able to rebuild this minor league system, or is he going to flush it out and it's just going to end up being barren? What's your read on what kind of GM Dave Dombrowski is going to be? Because he's obviously put his fingerprints on this organization now. He owns this place. But now what's he going to do going forward? Jason Groom is an interesting guy. He's a high-end prospect. But Theo Epstein and Hazen and Charrington, they just churned him out year after year after year. Is Dombrowski going to be able to do anything reasonable, or are the Red Sox minor league system going to become a little like the Tigers, which is not very good?
Well, I guess to know that, we'd have to know how long Dave Dombrowski wants to be the GM of the Red Sox. You know, does he view this as his last stop? Clearly he is motivated, highly so, to try to win now, to, you know, look at that three-year window that comes up in 17, 18, and 19 and get a couple of pennants and a couple of trips to the World Series and see if they can't win multiple titles with this nucleus of players. You've got the, you know, three frontline starters or guys who have been frontline starters, Porcello, and then you've got, that young, just now coming into their prime group of position players like Bogarts and Betts and Bradley and Benintendi, and they're primed to win and compete now. Dombrowski has never seemed to be a guy who is worried about what things are going to look like 5 years down the road. He's in win now mode and figure it out later. And given that, you know, he's now coming up, he'll turn 61, I think, later this year. You don't think he's going to be doing this forever. And I think if he could finish out this this stop on his resume with a couple of more trips to the World Series, then he'd be pretty happy and content with that and not terribly worried about what sort of farm system he's leaving for his successor.
With the Red Sox, you add Chris Sale and you add Thornburg. We're not going to get into Thornburg today, but you add Chris Sale, but you deduct David Ortiz. They're out of the Red Sox, and how big of a loss is David Ortiz going to be? Because I don't hear it. Granted, it's winter, and maybe the Boston market isn't talking about the Red Sox as much as they should be, but it doesn't seem like anyone is saying that the loss of David Ortiz, who had, as I said, a top five MVP season last year, is going to be an enormous loss. No one seems to be saying that. Maybe they will when the season comes along, but that's my question to you. Is it quiet because it's January, or is it quiet because people are just ignoring the fact that David Ortiz was really good last year, and without him, they lost a lot.
I think it's more a function of maybe people getting excited about Sale and looking at the fact that, you know, they probably have the best rotation in the league or one of the two best rotations in the league. And I think that, you know, certainly – the Red Sox are going to miss David Ortiz. The guy had an OPS over 1,000. He had 37 homers. He had a great season, forgetting the fact that he was 40 years old. That would be a great season for a 30-year-old slugger or a 25-year-old slugger. And so, of course, he'll be missed. But I think maybe what you might be skipping over, Chris, is the fact that to bring up one of the dreaded phrases from the end of the Theo Epstein era, run prevention, there are two wins, two ways to win games. One is to score more runs than the opposition, obviously, and the other is team from scoring as many runs. And while they certainly are not going to be the offensive team they were a year ago when they scored 870 or so runs and led the American League, they may be a much better team in keeping down what the opponents do. So, you know, instead of winning games 6-4, you win them 3-2, and that's just another pathway to wins. I have no doubt that Ortiz's presence in the lineup will be felt. But, you know, they're probably looking at it like they're going to get more out of Benintendi than they did a year ago, that they're going to get something from Pablo Sandoval. What it is, they're probably not sure yet. And no matter what they do offensively, sending Chris Sale out there to pitch 210 innings and make 33 starts is going to, you know, lower the runs scored against them by, you know, whoever, you know, give me a number. But it's certainly, you know, 33 starts from Chris Sale is going to be better than, you know, 16 from Clay Buchholz and, you know, 17 from a bunch of guys being brought up from the minor leagues.
Yeah, and also, not only do they add Andrew Benintendi, who is not offensively going to replace David Ortiz, but when you have the best center fielder maybe in all of baseball in Bradley, one of the best right fielders who should be playing center field in Mookie Betts, and Andrew Benintendi, who's probably a center fielder who's stuck playing in left field, they have one of the best defensive outfields. No matter what Andrew Benintendi does offensively, defensively, he should be a plus addition there too. And you know, if you love Adam Eaton, you probably need to really like what Benintendi is going to do, at least defensively as well. So that adds to, I think, your point. That's what essentially what you're saying. We got to let Sean go, but one final question before you go, just quickly: the AL East, has it been too passive, or are the Red Sox just more aggressive? What's going on with these teams who are supposed to be playoff contenders like the Orioles and Jays? They're not really doing anything. They're letting their guys go, or at least they're not aggressively signing anyone, at least at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the Jays did get, you know, did do some things earlier, not as dramatic. They got Kendrys Morales to essentially replace, take your pick, either Bautista or Encarnacion. I still think that's going to be a pretty good team. They'll score some runs. I think you got Sanchez, who's got his feet wet and doesn't have that innings limit. I think Toronto is still a wild card contender. Baltimore, I'm shocked they were as good as they were a year ago. You know, I still have major questions about their rotation. We'll see if they get anything out of Bundy and Gausman this year, two guys that, you know, maybe turned the corner a little bit a year ago. But, you know, they may be without the 47 homers they got from Trumbo. And it seems like, as usual, Dan Duquette is trying to do things on the cheap and get some undervalued players that he hopes overachieve. The Yankees are, you know, they're pointing toward 18 and 19. I think they'll be competitive, but it's hard to see them as a playoff team. And Tampa seems like, you know, the clock has struck midnight on their little Cinderella story from 5 or 6 years ago, where they were the great overachievers in the sport. A lot of those guys have moved on. They're starting to have some pitchers who are going to cost them some money in arbitration and may have to deal those guys away. But it's frankly hard to see how the Rays are a factor until they get their stadium situation straightened out. It so handcuffs them in terms of resources and payroll that it's hard to believe that they can compete in a division like the AL East with some of the powers that are there and try to do so on an $80 million budget.
Yeah, I get the sense that everyone believes that eventually Mark Trumbo's going back to Baltimore. But when you look at that,
yeah,
Chris
it
Davis
may well
trade,
be. It may well be that Trumbo does go back there, but you know we're getting into mid-January now, and maybe teams are going to, maybe agents and free agents are going to become a little more desperate. But as currently constituted, the Orioles, who probably overachieved a year ago, are not as good as they were last year, and you know that could be an issue.
You can follow him on Twitter, at Sean_McAdam. Sean, love talking baseball with you. Hopefully we'll have you back on in the coming weeks ahead. But thanks for bringing it to us in January, and be safe out there in the snow.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Enjoy coming on, and look forward to talking to you soon.
That's John McAdam. Again, follow him on Twitter, formerly of CSN New England and the Providence Journal. Knows his stuff. Great baseball guy. Love talking American League and baseball in general. We just never have enough time. Maybe I just ramble too much, I guess. There's always so many topics I'd like to get to. We get through a little bit of it, but we got to start with the Red Sox. If you're talking with Sean McAdam, anyone who's ever been in this market knows that Sean's as good as you get when it comes to talking about the Red Sox in the American League East. So I have to talk mostly Red Sox. It's not because I'm a homer. It's because, A, I'm a homer, and, B, Sean really does know them as well as anybody. So we had lots of topics we'd like to get to. Hopefully we'll have Sean back on, and we'll talk about some of those topics more on as we get later on in the winter and closer to spring training. There's lots of topics that didn't necessarily have to be spoken about today. So today we did Red Sox. We talked a lot about that. Obviously, we skimmed over the American League East because Sean had to go. But hopefully in the future, we'll be able to cover more topics and get more in-depth with the American League East. You know, I can only keep these people for so long. They're donating their time. They're being very generous with me as it is. So I can't keep them all here for an hour and a half every single show. Sometimes I'm able to keep them here and cuff them to the broadcast microphone. But we got what we could today. We heard a lot about the Boston Red Sox, and in the process we kind of skimmed through and laid out the broad strokes when it came to the American League. So that was our program for today. And again, if you want to follow Sean McAdam, if you want to know about what's going on in baseball, and especially with the Red Sox, especially with the American League East, but just baseball in general, follow Sean over there at Twitter at Sean MCADAM. Let me give it to you again here at Sean _ MCADAM. So it's at Sean _McAdam. He was of CSN New England and of the Providence Journal. He just recently parted ways with them, but I have no doubt that he'll be talking baseball and hopefully covering the Red Sox for someone not in the not too distant future. We've got a volatile media world these days, and Sean just so happens to be in between jobs at the moment. So he was of those locations. And I have no doubt that he'll be doing something for somebody very soon because, as I said, I'm not just brown-nosing here. I try not to kiss ass. Sean does do it extremely well and has been doing covering the Red Sox for quite some time. And that's why I like to have him on so often. He knows what he's talking about. He does a very good job. So follow him over on Twitter, at Sean McAdam. I'm Chris Mitchell. You can follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73. I post these podcasts over at MinorLeagueBall.com. If you want to read my writing or follow any of the podcasts over there, John Sickles is runs the site. He's a very well-known prospect writer. He's been doing it for a very long time. That's his little niche corner of SB Nation. It's called MinorLeagueBall.com. I post my podcast. I do a lot of baseball talk, podcasting and writing. I don't write about prospect as much for MinorLeagueBall.com as I do for my other sites. I do some writing for Baseball America, who's a prospect site as well. And yet I write about fantasy sports and not a lot about prospects for them too. But then when I actually write about prospects, I write about them from a fantasy sports perspective, and I do that over at rotoexperts.com. So if you want to follow me in a variety of different locations, depending on what you want to read about, it's minorleagueball.com or rotoexperts.com, or you can even go to baseballamerica.com. I think I'm going to be writing some articles about pitchers and things like that for the upcoming fantasy season. I wrote their pitcher projections for their fantasy magazine, which I think it's coming out in the next few weeks or so. Probably, I know their handbook comes out at the end of January. I think the Fantasy Magazine will probably come out. It would be seems a little strange if it came out in January. That seems a little early for a Fantasy Magazine. But people are already doing mock drafts. I'm talking baseball all off season. So I guess the magazine, you want to get it out there early, let people do their prep early. But I would still be surprised. The magazine, I'd be surprised if it comes out any earlier than February. But I had to do my write-ups in December, so that has me confused. If I'm doing my write-ups in the middle to the end of December, and yet the magazine doesn't come out until March, that seems a little bit strange too. I don't know if a magazine needs to be developed and prepped and all that, and then printed and sent out. I don't know. I don't know the process of how it takes to produce, print, distribute, and then sell a magazine. I don't know how long that time period takes, but it seems like a long separation to have my – I think I finished the write-up somewhere around December 15th or 16th. And because of that, some of the analysis will be a little bit changed because as we get closer to the season, a lot of my – some of the players weren't even on teams when I was projecting them. So there'll be some changes there, but I don't know. But anyway, if you want to follow my pitcher projection, you got to go out and buy America Fantasy Magazine. I did the projections for them last year. I did it for them again this year. Very detailed. It was a lot of work. I wrote up, I think, 200 pitchers, 150 starters, 1 through 150, and then I ranked 50 relievers. And in the process of doing those 50 relievers, what I did was with the closer situations being in flux, not only in December, but they'll probably still be in flux even as we get closer to spring training. In those situations where you really couldn't tell who the reliever was going to be, I put all three of them. I gave you a breakdown of what those three pitchers or two or three or four relievers brought to the table, what their potential was. I gave you an idea of who I thought would be the closer, who I thought would what they'd be able to do if they were the closer. And then I gave you an alternative value to players if things changed. So while I wrote up about 50, it was probably 8 or 10 closer situations that truly are a coin flip. We just don't know what the heck's going on. Who knows what's going on with the Nationals? Can you honestly tell me who is definitely going to be the closer for the Nationals right now? I mean, it looks like Sean Kelly could be. It looks like he would be best suited to be the guy, but do we know that he's the guy? It looks like they could still go out and trade for somebody at some point. So in some cases, there were probably at least 5 and maybe as many as 10 situations that were so up in the air that I did write-ups for essentially anywhere from 2 to 4 pitchers for one team. So that added another 10 or 15 write-ups essentially. So I wrote up somewhere between 200 and 225 write-ups probably for them. So some pretty detailed write-ups. So if you're looking for some fantasy analysis and when it comes to pitcher rankings, and I know the magazine's also going to have, I think, the hitters too. I didn't do the hitters. Somebody else did, but they're going to be in the magazine as well. So if you're a fantasy person and you want to get a detailed projection and analysis on these players, I would highly recommend you head on over and buy that magazine when it comes out. I'm sure you can buy it directly at baseballamerica.com. But again, I wrote up probably 100 to 150 words for anywhere between 75 and 100 of the pitchers. Then I wrote up probably 50 to 75 words for the other 50 to 75. And then I did something around 100 words for each of the relievers. And with those ones where there were 3 or 4 of them, there were probably as many as 200 words. So there's a lot of not only the projections and the rankings, but explanations and analysis. I did a lot of research on fan graphs and baseball reference. I compared previous years. You know, I put a lot of work into it. So if you want a detailed look at what's going on with the fantasy projections for the pitchers for this upcoming season, I would recommend going out. Baseball America does a great job with everything they do. So even if you don't like what I'm doing or what I provide you in that fantasy magazine, there's going to be a lot of other good stuff in it as well. So I highly recommend you buy that magazine for whatever reason. But if you want my projections, you can find them over there. See season at rotoexperts.com as well. So if you want to go over there, you'll be able to see weekly articles. And if you want to become an insider at rotoexperts.com, you can buy the draft kit. And I'll be doing prospect writing for those. So I'm going to be doing a top 25 for 2017, their impact on Major League Baseball. If you want to know about 2017, about just in general, my top 25 prospects, not based on the 2017 season, but prospect rankings in general, I'm going to be doing an article for that as well. And then there's some other articles I'm hoping to write that I got to get the okay from my editors for, because I gave them a bunch of ideas, and we'll see what they like and what they don't like. They don't take my suggestions all that seriously, it seems like. I've had lots of suggestions over there for a long period of time, and much too often they say no thank you. But I know that at least some of those articles will be up. So head on over to rotoexperts.com. I'm working on some articles right now. I'm hoping to post a couple here in the next few days that I've been working on. So you can do that as well. Hoping to talk some more baseball this week. Brandon C. Williams has been doing programs with me a lot. I'm going to be posting some Hot Stove podcasts that I did with him recently. We did them in the last couple of weeks. They'll be posting here in the next couple, hopefully, days. And then we'll just keep talking baseball with him as we get moving along here in the winter. If you follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73, I always post links and descriptions of what's going on for the programs. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can just check my feed and find podcasts with Rob Nyer, Vince Lara from Baseball America. Kim Callis has been on my program a bunch of times. He's going to be coming on here in the next couple weeks to talk prospects. Sean McAdam hopefully will come back on. I'm hoping to have Joe Sheehan come on. He actually agreed to come on with me last winter. It just didn't happen, not because he refused. He just for some reason, things got busy and things didn't happen. But he agreed to do it before, so I'm hoping that he'll agree again to just to come on with me and talk baseball in general. Joe Posnanski agreed to come on with me last winter, and again, that just I got busy and we just didn't end up doing that podcast. But he was more than happy to come on last winter, so I'm assuming that once I contact him, he'll be willing to come on this year. I really like the takes that he has when it comes to sports. I think he's one of the more reasonable, rational guys out there writing about sports. So I'm excited to hopefully finally, for the first time, have him on the program this year. So the winter's coming up. And one of the projects I tried to take on last year, and I'm going to try to do it again this year, it's difficult. It's a pretty massive project. But I'm going to try to get as many writers to come on to talk about each individual team. And if I can, do a individual podcast specifically about each individual team for all of baseball. Now, again, that's a lot of teams. It's difficult. It's not always easy to find writers. Some local writers, some writers in general are much more willing to donate their time than others. That's what's so great about the ones that actually come on this program. Jim Callis is a very busy guy. He's one of the best prospect writers in all of baseball. And yet he's willing to come on my program really about every 6 or 8 weeks. It's amazing that he's willing to, with all of his time being so so valuable and so busy, yet he's willing to come on this podcast and talk with me. So I really appreciate when a Sean McAdam or a Jim Callis or a Rob Nyer or a Vince Lara come on here when they don't have a lot of time. And I'm sure a lot of people would love to have them on their shows, and yet they agree to come on mine. I don't know what's wrong with them. There's something wrong with these people that they're agreeing to actually talk to me, but they are. So it's not always so easy to find people. There have been multiple writers in multiple locations that never even respond to my request. Never mind don't say no, they just don't respond at all. Or they say I'm not interested at all. Or they say thank you but no thank you. And again, these people are busy. I don't blame them for not coming on. It's actually just the opposite. These are very busy people, and my podcast is not the priority of America, so I don't blame them in the least. But that makes it a little bit difficult. It's not always so easy to find somebody to come on, even for 30 minutes, to talk about an individual team, even if they cover them. But I'm going to do the best I can to try to find people, and hopefully do as many teams as I possibly can before spring training. So I'll try. I can't promise anything, but I'll do the best I can to get as many as I possibly can. So I'm in the process of trying to get that production going. But if you want, again, follow me on minorleagueball.com. Follow me on Twitter. If you want to talk baseball with me just in general, I have a couple of Facebook groups that if you want to join them to talk baseball, we'd love to have you. I would love to talk on Facebook with you rather than actually have to do work. I'd much rather procrastinate as you sit here listening to me talk. But if you want to follow on Facebook, and if you want to post things, if you want to just get into conversations, post topics, start debates. I was actually talking in a Facebook debate the other day, and actually got in, I guess you'd call it a fight. I got in a Facebook fight the other day in this prospect group that I comment in from time to time. It's not my group. I don't run it. I just comment in there from time to time. And this poster asked, and to me, I thought this was an idiotic question. I didn't call it idiotic at first. I just laughed and said, come on, man. Why are you wasting our time with something like this? That was essentially what I said. It wasn't even more snarky than that. It wasn't crude or rude. I wasn't insulting. I said, come on, man, really? You seriously are asking this question? He asked who he thought would be the better player this year. And it was from a fantasy perspective, but I think you can apply it to baseball in general. Eric Thames or Hanley Ramirez? I mean, seriously, is that a stupid question? Or am I stupid for calling it a stupid question? Eric Thames, I believe, was playing in North Korea. Yeah, I think he was playing in Korea last year. He wasn't really a very good player when he played in Major League Baseball. I mean, he made Chris Carter look like an all-star. So Chris Carter can't find a job at the moment. He was just released. He's been released 2 seasons in a row. And Eric Thames couldn't even beat Chris Carter in Major League Baseball. He had to go to Korea to play for a few years. Now he's coming back to Major League Baseball. And this guy, and Hanley Ramirez was a top 10 MVP candidate last year. I keep throwing out all these Red Sox and keep calling them top 10. Hanley Ramirez had a really good season last year. Now, I don't know what we're going to get next year. If the Red Sox have some struggles or they don't contend, I'm concerned that Hanley will just check out. You know, he gets these injuries, and when the games don't matter, these injuries become all of a sudden debilitating and he can't play. So I'm always concerned about Hanley Ramirez's attitude and his willing to dedicate his efforts to the team. especially when these things don't matter. So I am concerned about that, and there's always a possibility that Hanley just checks out and has a horrible season. But you had a top 10 player last, a top 10 MVP candidate in the American League for the Boston Red Sox on another contending organization who could possibly be one of the two or three best teams in the American League in a possible World Series contender, as we talked about on the podcast today. You've got one of their best sluggers compared to a guy who couldn't even play in America like the last three or four seasons and wasn't even that good when he was playing in America. And this guy is asking, who do you think is going to be better in 2016? Make a comment. As I said, I just said, come on, man. Why are you wasting our time? And he calls me a jerk, which I couldn't disagree with him. I said, he asked me, why are you always a jerk? And then he says, you know, dot, 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 seriously. So he wasn't even joking. And I was like, it comes naturally. It's just the way I am. I am a jerk. I am a jerk. I'm more than fat. I'll own it. I'm a jerk. I'm more than happy to say that. But then I said, but since you're so bold, let me tell you, your question was moronic, and I was being polite in saying what I said because it was a stupid question. Are you honestly telling me that it wasn't a stupid question? And then I outlined the same things that I just outlined to you. So if you want to get in fights, let's get in fights. Come on over to Facebook. It's a podcast to be named later. That's where I talk about baseball. That's where I post the podcast links in the rundowns for this podcast. Or if you want to talk fantasy sports, it's the rotoexperts.com fantasy sports show. I do podcasts for that. I do fantasy podcasts. We talk fantasy sports in there. I also post baseball stuff in there as well because baseball stuff impacts fantasy stuff. So if you want to talk fantasy sports, the rotoexperts.com fantasy sports show page or a podcast to be named later page, both on Facebook. If you want to fight with me, I'm more than happy to fight with you. If you just want to discuss things civilly and rationally and reasonably, I'm more than happy to do that as well. Or if you just want to post things, make comments, just get discussions going, we welcome that as well. So head on over to Facebook, join either of those groups, and let's talk some baseball. Again, I'd rather talk to you. You're irrational, and even if you're a jerk like that other guy was, then do work. So if you can help me avoid work, I appreciate that very much. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today. Again, hopefully you enjoyed talking and listening to Sean McAdam, and hopefully you'll be tuning into the podcast going forward. And as I said, head on over to minorleagueball.com or head over to those Facebook pages because Rob Nyer podcast has been posted. Vince Lehrer from Baseball America, we talk purely prospects in that podcast. That's been posted over at minorleagueball.com and is on the Facebook groups as well. So if you want to listen to those podcasts, and I highly recommend you do. We've had a lot of listeners for the Vince Lara one specifically. He's very good at talking prospects, and we did some interesting conversation. That one went on for about an hour and 20 minutes. So that was a pretty lengthy podcast with a lot of information on a lot of different topics. So I head on over for that. But thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. Enjoy the snow, or if you're in the warm weather locations, congratulations to you. But everyone, hopefully you had a great, fantastic holidays, and hopefully you're going to enjoy the rest of the winter with me, hopefully talking some baseball. Thanks, everybody. Be good.